Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the 2023 7th Annual Converge to Accelerate Hybrid Symposium. In this session on developing a secure internet-based network of trusted data, we will discuss how businesses, healthcare organizations, and academic pioneers are addressing digital transformation challenges and opportunities to preserve digital identity, data provenance, universal access, and secure privacy-preserving transactions in the rapidly evolving world of digital transformation, including how to harness socially responsible global data sharing. There's a lot to talk about here. I'm your moderator. My name is Florence Hudson. I am the executive director of the Northeast Big Data Innovation Hub at Columbia University in the city of New York and CEO of FT Hint, a global consulting firm in advanced technology and diversity and inclusion. I'm also on the IEEE Engineering and Medicine and Biology Society Standards Committee and on the Blockchain and Healthcare Today editorial board. Our guest speaker today is Thomas Harjono. Thomas, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Florence. I'm excited to be discussing these topics with you today. My name is Thomas Harjono. I am the CTO of a group at MIT called Connection Science and Data Trust. We work on various aspects of the data economy, the data-driven society, including, you know, technology, technical, engineering side, all the way to the socio-technical, the people side. So your questions are very much what we do here in our group at MIT. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you. We're delighted to have you. And at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it's wonderful when we talk about technology and the humans, right? Sometimes I know in academia and in research, I was at NASA, I was at IBM for many years, but in the research side, sometimes we forget about the humans. And it's so important in what we're talking about that we're including both. So I'm always so impressed with what goes on at MIT, and we're delighted to have you. So let's jump right in. If you could please share with our audience what this topic means to you and how it relates to the work you do now and expect to do in the future on developing a secure internet-based network of trusted data.
Sure. Thank you, Florence. So the big challenge is that it's very clear that society is data-driven. So that means that a lot of decisions being made by communities, by society, by governments, in policymaking and so on, is dependent on data. And it's clear to everyone who owns a smartphone, owns devices at homes, we're generating a lot of data just in our active living. And so it's not just the usage of the data, but how do you actually manage the data? Because, your data, my data will reflect, will provide the ability for people to find out more private information. So there's this question about privacy. And so going into the future, I think the issue of data computation, and of course, more recently, we've heard about AI and generative AI and large language models. Don't forget that behind all these keywords, there's another important word, which is data. Large LLMs and generative AI and ChatGPT will not work without, a huge amount of data to make it, understand about our behavior. But yeah, definitely, this is a topic that's close to my heart, close to our group at MIT.
I totally agree with you. And if I could add a couple of comments. So leading the Northeast Big Data Innovation Hub, which is funded by the National Science Foundation in the US, and we also have had some funding from the National Institutes of Health. When we talk about a secure internet-based network of trusted data, there are many things, there are so many words in there, right? A secure internet-based network of trusted data, and then we talk about blockchain, how secure is that? And then you're talking about privacy of data, and there are different rules and regulations around the world. There are privacy-preserving technologies, and then there's actually making sure that the data provenance, that the data can be trusted, and that you can trust the people or devices or services trying to access your data. Can they access it? Can they change it? There are just so many issues in there. And those are some of the challenges that we deal with in the big data hubs. Let's try to enable data sharing. But oh, wait a second, You know, who are we letting in? You know, what are the trust and identity issues? And just to add a little piece to that, to kind of expand the thought, one of the things that we do with IEEE, the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, is I lead a global working group on clinical Internet of Things data and device interoperability with TIPS. And TIPS is a new framework we're creating that stands for trust, identity, privacy, protection, safety, and security. And it relates to the data, it relates to the devices, it relates to the humans, it relates to the enterprise. There are so many things to think about. So as we get to this secure data sharing opportunity, there's so much value in it. You know, let's leverage the data together and get more insight and improve outcomes in general. But there are so many challenges. So what are the challenges that you see today and in the future in this topical area?
Yeah. Yeah, great you mentioned IEEE. I love the IEEE. I've been a member of the IEEE since undergrad, which is, you know, I don't want to say when because I might reveal too much, but it's great to, you know, to see the IEEE getting involved here because we will be needing standards for this. But back to your, you know, bigger question about challenges. So if I had to put it in a single sentence, yes, we've got, you know, distributed, you know, data models and so on. You know, the bigger question is how do you compute on data that you don't own and you don't hold, right? So increasingly, people have, you know, enormous amounts of data behind, you know, firewalls, essentially they're siloed. Mm. And, you know, before GDPR in Europe, before the, you know, the data privacy regulations was enacted, people are probably more lax about this and people are able to, are willing to, you know, give other people outside the organization copies of data sets, but no longer, because now you have, you know, certain liabilities for holding data about citizens. So the question becomes, well, you know, if you have a data repository, you know, you have 10 data repositories, you have 100 data repositories, and they're all siloed, how do you interconnect them? And I think the answer really is that some of the words we use imply certain technologies, and often it's a mismatch. So instead of talking about data sharing, we like to talk about sharing insights about, you know, society, about groups and so on, because really in the majority of cases, what you really want is insights, right? You know, and this is typical of, you know, Bureau of Statistics types of data and questions that people are interested in. Well, you know, how many people in the north of Boston have COVID? Okay, you don't have to know exactly who, but like, give me a number, right? So that's the first sort of approaches, share insights. And so that means the people who hold these data silos are more apt, they're more amenable, you know, to helping you get these insights. And so then the question becomes, well, how do you collectively generate an insight that's useful for society? And so this, we've been looking at this at MIT for almost a decade. And the model we've arrived at is basically, you know, you really need to standardize APIs through these silos, and also you need to define acceptable questions, the queries, you know, the questions. And the questions could be expressed in, you know, complex statistics language like R, whatever it is, or you know, maybe in Python or maybe in pseudocode in English, right? But you know, if I ask you, you know, Flo, please compute this question on your data store and just give me the answer, I think you will be more open as an organization to do that. You might say, you know, yes, I'll do it, but for a fee. That's fine. We can talk about, you know, remuneration models, you know, later on. But I think that's the direction. This, I think, the only viable direction for society going forward is for all sides to respect the data and the subjects that are implied by that data, and collaborate to come up with interesting questions so that and useful questions, you know, to communities and to society.
Very interesting. So what about that? I totally agree that sharing the insights is a lot easier. And I know I was working with a researcher at Boston University that was doing secure multi-party computation. I don't know if you've been involved with that before, but I think that might be a technique that can be used sometimes.
That's right.
And so maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the idea of MPC, so multi-party computation is a sub-discipline in cryptography that's at least 20 years old. I mean, I remember reading, you know, papers back in the, you know, early 90s on this topic. And the challenge is that you are trying to share computation to derive this insight amongst parties who may not be friends, and in fact, they may be competitors. It could be financial institutions that are effectively in the market competitors. So how do you get them to work together? And so in the MPC model, each, let's say there's three or four parties in the in this particular instance, they would prepare the data and encrypt it in a specific manner using specific parameters. And so each would arrive at this encrypted blob, essentially, and then, each would deliver these copies of the blobs to the other parties. So at the end of the first kind of stage, all four parties will have four blobs, their own and three others. And the thing, the great thing about MPC, computation is that each party can then, using those four blobs or four pieces, can in fact compute on their own in their own space and come up with the same answer. Mm. And so the key thing is that the MPC algorithm must guarantee that all parties arrive at the same answer, right? So it could be as simple as, compute the average of, salaries of four people is my favorite example, right? So because that's what you're interested in, is the average salary, not Alice's salary or Bob's salary, but it has a lot of promise. It is computationally very intensive and bandwidth intensive. So researchers are continually refining and coming up with different MPC models or secure multiparty computation schemes to overcome some of these, limitations.
Interesting. Do you envision that quantum or other like parallel computing abilities would be able to help with that?
I hope so. Quantum goes both directions. So if you have high speed, solving some of these bandwidth and CPU sort of bottlenecks in the MPC, it could also be used to break stuff, right? Definitely the quantum computing has promise in this particular MPC space.
Yeah. So I think that is going to be interesting. I agree with you. With any tool, you can use it for good or for bad, right? With anything. You can drive in a car to get somewhere faster, or God forbid, it can go into something and hurt somebody or something. So anything could be used for good or bad, even though it was envisioned to be used for good. And so that's going to be one of the challenges and opportunities with the advent of some of these new technologies too, I think. Similar to the internet. Oh, you can get to everything. Oh no, you can get to everything, And then, has the security and privacy issue. And as we look at the trusted data side of it and the challenges there, I think there's so many issues with data. Was it captured properly? Was it hacked on the way? Was part of it lost? Where did it come from? And do you really know it came from there? Who's touched it? Then there are issues like, when Germany first came out with their cloud regulations, they said any data created in Germany stays in Germany. And I remember I was traveling with my Fitbit and I was thinking, do I have to leave my Fitbit in Germany? understanding what these different rules are, but then also from a responsible data science perspective and responsible use of data and secure data, do you have any thoughts about how you can actually check the provenance of data or validate data?
Yeah, I think this is part of the evolution of enterprise data management, right? Organizations, enterprises, really need to know and keep track, keep a log. You almost need a separate system to log just data set files. Was it generated internally? Was it imported? If it's imported into the boundary of the enterprise, who did it? What purpose? And so people talk about data as an asset, and for enterprises, data is asset. But you think about it, if you're a bank and you're managing people's money, your own money, you want to track the movement where did my money go to and so on. So you almost need to treat data like you treat money. And just internally good housekeeping. And I think there's a lot of opportunity, I think, for enterprise software companies to actually come up with new products, new ideas to help enterprises, because in my work at MIT, we've seen so many organizations who actually don't even know where files are within their own organization, right? You know, and so this is a challenge, has been a challenge generally, you know, for the past two decades, but now with the increase of value and appreciation of the value of data, plus the new regulations about data privacy, you know, really enterprises need to keep track of it. Now, this also applies to service providers whose business is generating and managing data. For example, telco companies, right? They have customer data. Banks have transaction data, credit card data, right? I think this is becoming, you know, relevant for these traditional sectors, but also for these sort of new upcoming company startups, you know, in AI, you know, AI related services, LLM types, you know, services, you know, if they are going to provide services for outbound outside customers, they themselves need to track, you know, did this data set come from one of my customers, customer A, or did it come from customer B? Did I agree to ensure there's a firewall between these two data sets? You know, do employees have employees running off with, you know, is there data theft? You know, how do I prove there isn't data theft? Am I using the latest data addressed in a protection technologies to ensure that, you know, data doesn't sort of get lost? But these are all part of the sort of enterprise organization challenges going forward.
Totally agree with you. And on that point, you know, maybe things were simpler when it was within an enterprise, and now we have people sharing data all over the place. Or if I'm wearing like an implanted medical device, let's say, thank God I don't have one yet, but, you know, when I go to a different country, and my doctor is trying to keep an eye on what's going on with me, or they need an emergency firmware update. Oh my gosh. Yes. You know, yes. How there's so many issues with that. And that's one of the things we're trying to address in these standards we're working on with IEEE and Underwriters Laboratories. So what about the trust and identity pieces? How do you know that's really the doctor? You know, how do you know they're affiliated with that organization, with that healthcare provider? How do you validate their identity? How often do you validate their identity? They're that's keeping right. an eye that's on right. you all day, like every microsecond, every 10 minutes. Like, how do you decide? You know, and this is to enable, you know, privacy, the data, protection of the human, protection of the data, you know, and then the ongoing safety and security. So there are issues within an enterprise, you know, including insider threat, you know, like, you know, people who take data they shouldn't take and then share it with people they shouldn't share it with. But then there's also all these degrees of freedom of all these, you know, facets and angles of attack, as we say, in cybersecurity, right? So what are some of your thoughts on what we can do in any of those areas? I know I brought so many up, but
So just in the same way that, in the group, we classified this problem under the personal data store problem, PDS problem. And that is that just like, you know, a bank today has an account that has my money in it, in the future, it's quite possible that we have organizations, private sector, you know, companies that offer personal data storage and management for individual citizens. So to use your specific, you know, case where, you know, you've got a hard pace, you know, monitor and you're in Europe, you know, maybe one, you know, speaking as an engineer, IEEE engineer here, one possibility would be that my hard pacer would communicate via my smartphone, via Bluetooth, and my smartphone would just upload all my data into my personal store in the cloud somewhere. And the cloud could be operated by this, you know, new types of service provider. But the key thing is, this fiduciary obligation, that's an important word, because a bank, a money bank today, by definition, they have fiduciary obligations. They have to put me, the customer, as number one. You know, it's their obligation. And so a personal data store provider is not just, you know, a cloud storage provider, you know, that we have today. It's more than that. It's actually a data management company. And it's interesting because then, you know, they are in a good position to actually come up with interesting ways to you know, derive revenue for themselves, right? So I don't like the word monetize because it's abused too much. It kind of means, well, I'm going to sell your data to the marketing guys, and that's how I'm. There's more clever ways to entice people to come into such an ecosystem. And one of the models we've been looking at least from the legal organization perspective, is what we know in the United States as a credit union, because a credit union, unlike a bank, sees me as a member. So if you go to any credit union, you know, it's like, oh, here's a member, not a customer, right? And so we've been studying that model to see, well, they have the same fiduciary, you know, obligations, legal fiduciary obligations as a bank. Could this model be used for a future personal data store management company, right? And if you think about, well, if you have a company, you know, the other model is a data cooperative, right? Just, you know, everybody's familiar with the farmers co-op from way back in the Depression times in the 30s. It's continued. We have co-ops today, you know, just talking to, you know, someone from the largest milk, you know, producing co-op in the country. And many of them are farming, you know. So the concept is very familiar, but what if you could have a data cooperative where, you know, it's run as a professional organization, it has fiduciary obligations, and people pay a fee. I'll pay, you know, annually, whatever, $40 a year, $50, $100 a year to this, you know, organization to help keep my data, and in fact, maybe even sort it out. Here's my telco data, here's my health data, here's my heart pacer data, right? So the question is, once you have, you know, a data co-op, isn't that a great way to begin to share insights? Because if you have a data co-op with 50,000 members in North, you know, New England, and suddenly we have an emergency need like a COVID thing coming up, you know, I could authorize the data co-op to say, hey, do a computation on whatever tracing you need, right? But the key thing is that I have a copy of my data and I can control how I manage it, who I delegate management to, you know, under some legal framework so that, you know, both sides are satisfied. So those are some of the things we look at in the group.
That's very interesting. And then there would be rules related to if you anonymize the data before you send it
in. Yes, that's right. Yes. So that becomes Yeah. Governance. So the data co-op needs its own governance. So this is one of the things we've been, you know, researching. Well, what kind of governance would you conceivably need in a data cooperative?
Mm. And I guess it would differ from many perspectives. It would differ based on regulation of wherever you are, whether it's state level regulation, like in California, in the US, California tends to be on the leading edge of this privacy and security. Or it's based on which other jurisdiction you're in by country, or like in the European Union. So there would be regulations. I guess there could also be norms related to different industries, as an example.
That's right. And also somebody's personal data actually originates from different verticals in the industry. So there's the telco vertical, so my telco data on my smartphone, right? And then the GPS. Okay, so could be that my device generates the GPS location, call data records, and then you know, my travel, you know, my Uber trips, my train trips, right? So all that data comes from different verticals in the industry. I have the right to have copies of it. Mm-hmm. But today the problem is the data holders, now these verticals, are not ready to give me a copy of my data. Oh, it's in a format that's not standardized. And so suddenly I get, you know, 100 different files. If I was a non-technical person, I'd be like, well, number one, where do I put this? Number two, how do I sort out the telco data set from my, you know, Uber data set? And so this is why the data co-op, you know, presents a great business opportunity for startups who are, you know, wishing to sort of go into that space, into that direction.
Yeah. And I guess the question is, who would you trust to do that for you? Right. There's the whole trust piece of that, like, oh, sure, here, take all my data, you know, and then all you need to do is go in there, you know, with one little pin, and the balloon blows
that's
up.
That's right. So this is the separate topic. Well, how do you protect the data in the back end? regardless of the front end institution, whether it's a data bank, it's a government data store, whether it's a data co-op, there's this universal need of protecting data at rest. And that's why people are looking at, you know, encryption solutions, MPC, and more recently, confidential computing using, you know, new types of hardware, new types of CPU hardware.
Right. Yeah. And there's the security and privacy of the data. And then, as we were saying, who can get into it and who can't, and people hacking your identity. Right.
That's right.
So I know, you know, at one point, we're like, oh, biometrics will fit everything, fix everything. I'm like, okay, well, you know, if they hack your fingerprint, you know, that's your finger, you know, you're probably not going to be changing that, you know, so that, you know, if somebody hacks and gets your password, you can create a new password. But if somebody hacks your eyeball, you know, you don't want a new eyeball, right? So I think, like, as we look at some of these new technologies for trust and identity, you have to look at the range of uncertainty of what could happen.
That's,
you know,
right.
How could it go bad?
That's right.
Are those some of the things that, like, you're thinking about as well?
That's right. Yes. So some of our collaborators and sponsors at MIT come from the insurance industry, and so they take on a risk management sort of perspective on this. And so for a case like this, you know, they'll say, well, like, you know, what is the risk associated with using this backend technology? What about that backend technology? Right. And it's always for them, it's always and I guess for us also, how do you weigh the risk and the functionality? Right. Because you could certainly, you know, provide 100% security, but it may not be functional. You can't use it for anything. Right. So there's always a toss. But I think the key thing from our research here at MIT is that there are certain principles that you can, you know, almost, you know, determine upfront. And for example, this, you know, moving the question to the data is a good principle. We call this the open algorithm set of principles. And data really needs to stay where it is and not be copied around, right? This is sort of second principle. And a third principle, well, you need to protect the data in the back end of wherever the endpoint in is. So if it's a data co-op, well, the data co-op needs to acquire, you know, buy data protection technology for their backend, and that needs to be computed into the business model of a data co-op. And as a member, that's my membership fee, right? To pay for this, you know, technology.
Very good point. Well, this is just so exciting. I love listening to everything that y'all are thinking about. I have another question. Let's talk about tokenization and digital assets. That's a really hot topic, and it's getting
right.
And more people are trying to figure out what that really means. So could you give us your thoughts about tokenization and digital assets in this framework we're talking about of this, you know, secure internet of data?
Sure. So we could talk about this sort of generically, and then how does this sort of generic thing apply for personal data? So generically, of course, I don't have to go talk about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and so on, but to me, it seems there's now two almost classes of digital assets. The first one is money, and that's a separate, and this is the contentious, this is the headline grabbing, you know, this is FTX, this is, you know, all this stuff you see in the news is you know, can you come up with a different type of, you know, tokenized money, whether it's a tokenized deposit, a tokenized cash, is it government base, who issues? So that's a whole set of problems. And then there's this more, I think, more promising area, which is some people call it the Internet of Value. Web3 is the Internet of Value. And that is that how can I tokenize, how can I turn my favorite example, the Picasso in my basement, which is already raises flags. How can I turn the Picasso in my basement into a token where I could, you know, sell to you, Florence, on a blockchain somewhere. So there's implicit there. There's this almost two-step, three-step process where there's the, of course, authenticity, provenance of the asset that needs to be solved. There is some mechanism needed to verify the asset is true and that it could be, the technical term is immobilized and dematerialized is what the fintech people, the banks like to talk about. So for example, institutions such as the DTCC, Depository, can't remember the full name in New York, for example, their role is to issue paper certificates, now it's digital book entry form, for assets that could be barrels of oil, you know, tons of gold, whatever it may be. And so these institutions are effectively doing two things at the same time. They're making sure the asset doesn't move, kind of difficult to move around, you know, 10 tons of gold. but, you know, they fix that. And then they dematerialize, meaning that they issue an electronic certificate for this, you know, asset. And so the next step is how can you represent that electronic certificate into a token structure on a blockchain? So that sort of value chain itself is quite distinct from cryptocurrencies and money. It's almost two separate universes. And I think a lot of the confusion in the media today is they're trying to mix these things together. And it's quite possible in the future that, you have a growth in this sort of tokenization of physical assets and trading on the blockchain across multiple blockchains. There will be multiple blockchains out there for sure. This is how the internet, you know, evolved, and some will be public permissionless, like, you know, the well-known today's Ethereum. Some will be closed and private, such as some of the, you know, experiments, you know, proof of concept being developed today by some financial institutions. But it's quite likely that these two tracks need to be interconnected for payments and settlements, because it's very clear now that so people talk about government money as having three things, you know, store of value, kind of the, you guys know what I'm talking about. But more importantly, my greenback paper that I have in my pocket is a direct claim on the U.S. Fed. Mm-hmm. If you use something in between, like a stable coin, people talk about stable, this is a privately issued token money, it's not a direct claim. And so you lose the veracity, you lose the brand, the reputation of the Fed is not behind this. And this is what we saw in Terra USD, that the company Terra Luna, it was also front page. Right? So I think we're in an exciting time. People sometimes lump them together as Web3. And I tend to think, well, you know, it's more complex than that. But I, you know, the Internet of Value is actually a phrase that I learned from John Yang, who's a president of one of the big blockchain companies, Avalanche. And he described it quite well. You know, in the old days, the Internet 2 was, you know, Web 2 was to move data across, me sending you email, people sharing Instagram photos, you know. But in the future, it could be that I'm sending you the deeds to, you know, a property that's, you know, somewhere, you know, in the world.
Very interesting. How does that apply to healthcare or medicine?
Right. So this is some folks in our group are trying to understand if, access to the insights being computed on data could be tokenized.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Right. So you're not tokenizing data. You're not tokenizing the money. You're saying, well, you know, there's this private data, health data repository that has, you know, cancer data for 100,000 people. Right. So, wow, that's valuable. If you're a pharma company, you're probably drooling. It's like, wow, this is super. And make it even more interesting. Oh, here's a data set for like complete, you know, data biobank for 20 million people. That's like, oh my God, that's a gold mine, right? And so maybe what you're trying to tokenize is the insights, the access to the insights. And so it could be that you have a collaboration of, you know, we like to use the word consortium, a data consortium of these data holders, where they could pre-compute, pre-publish these questions that I spoke earlier about, the insights into, you know, computable insights, you know, it's like literally Python code or, you know, pseudo code. Yeah. And it's still private. And if you are, you know, a pharma company wanting specific types of insights, you could pay to get this organization to compute, to run this algorithm for me on this 100,000 patients. right? And that might cost them whatever, $1,000. And then the pharma company goes back and says, you know what? Out of these 100,000 people, we're really interested in this 10,000. This is all anonymized. So the pharma company doesn't know who these 10,000 are. And so you say, oh, could you run this more specific algorithm on this 10,000 people? Because we're trying to identify a cohort of a subset of these 10,000 people who have these particular traits. So as the insights gets more complicated to, the algorithm to be designed and computed, the cost, raises, goes up, right? So in a sense, yes, the data providers, data holders are happy because they're making revenue to pay for the infrastructure, to all this stuff we talked about, data protections, and then the consumer, the customer, for example, the pharma companies are also satisfied because suddenly they can plan for next year's expenditure budget, to work on this small cohort, right? Because as you know, in healthcare, there's a lot of, trials needed. And sometimes, I mean, my understanding is there's a huge amount of money is being wasted on doing trials on the wrong cohort, so to speak, or just the imprecise match of the the design and the cohort of people, patients.
That's very interesting. It sounds like you're saying that the insights could be kind of like at, kind of a critical mass level for like a pharma or someone who's doing research and trying to figure out how to zone in on things. But I'm wondering, could that also be like at the precision medicine and precision healthcare level where?
That's right. That's right. So it could be that if I was a patient whose data is in within this 100,000 person cohort, I could, log in and put a flag up saying, hey, you look, I've got this very rare disease, terminal. I'm willing, for my data to be run on these, searches, and I'm willing to, receive, PMI services to help me, solve some of my medical issues. And this is why the data co-op model is, it's not just, it's a community-based thing, and members need to feel the benefit of this. And sometimes benefit is not necessarily money. Mm-hmm. It's access to information, access to medical expertise, maybe access to the latest drugs, in the labs of these pharma companies, right? Who knows? But we need to keep the channels open to make all the stakeholders happy and, see the value in participating in the ecosystem.
I love that, and actually now we're getting into my last question, which is the socio-technical challenges and opportunities. So we're talking about the humans here, which I love, it's all about the humans. And so maybe you could share a little bit about the social science perspective and the technical perspective and how you see them coming together.
Sure. So a bit of background, our group is called at MIT Human Dynamics and Connection Science, and the word connection science is about how people connect with each other. It's not about the social graph. It's not, connections, but social graph, no, it's not. Social graphs are useful for some things, but it's not real. But really the gist is how do we understand how people behave in communities and in society, and how can we use data to help them solve, predict certain conditions in the future? Maybe it's a potential spread of a new virus. You've just been through COVID and you saw how ineffective many of these contact tracing, proposals. There's at least 100 contact tracing startups that sort of showed up, and all of them suffer from the problem of, lack of access to good data. But so we're looking at, problems of how do you, for example, if you are a credit card company, how do you help your customers in predicting, financial stress, right? That could happen through many things. It could be that, my customer is moving jobs, moving from Massachusetts to California, the cost of living is going to go high. And so it provides opportunities for service providers in the financial sector to, intercept the problem. What's the word? To help the customer navigate through the problems in life. So that's individual customers. At the community level, most of us live in towns, at least this is a New England thing, in towns. And so really, I need a digital representation of my social connections to my neighbor, townsfolks, and so on. Why is that valuable? Well, it'd be good just to do everything from town planning, budget planning, to roads planning in the town and so on. And you scale that up to a city like Boston. I mean, the city of Boston would really need insights about where people are moving. Do they have enough transportation to move from A to B? And the other thing that you know, it's just a conjecture, a theory that we have that seems to be proven again and again on the data sets, is that if you take a particular region and geographic area, square mile, the more diverse, I'll explain what diversity here means, the more diverse set of people that come to that particular square mile, the higher the GDP output in that square mile going 5 years. So we have data on that. And the idea is that it's a thing called that our professor Sandy Pentland came up with. It's called idea flow. This is based on the premise that 500 years ago, you know, when people met at the market, it's not just to sell cows and buy sheep and buy chickens. It's also to gossip. Okay. And gossip is an exchange of information. And in fact, it's the gossip that represents the social network. It's not the trading. The trading is done in, you know, 2 minutes, right? And so farmers discussing things like, well, hey, the crops don't look good this year. It's going to so bring it forward to today. You know, could we have the same model whereby, you know, communities, my town, could share insights, share data, about whatever's happening in the town. And the scale, back to the Boston scale, if you have that square mile and you have diversity, so diversity means people come from different origins, different locations in the city. So, you know, into this square mile, people have different education levels, different types of jobs, different income levels, different race, of course, and different cultures. That together, when you let people interact, you end up with very interesting opportunities. Why? Well, because people sharing gossip, you know, the construction worker that's lining up at the coffee store with the banker, when they start talking to each other, they can talk about interesting things, right? They can share information across different barriers, so to speak. So that's kind of, you know, our sort of view of the big picture of, you know, these are some of the socio-technical value of data.
That's just excellent. You know, I think it really brings to life, you know, what this secure internet-based network of trusted data can be. It's data from the humans, it's data from the devices, it's insights from the data. There's so many different elements. And, you know, it's been such a pleasure to discuss these challenges and opportunities with you, Thomas. Thank you for sharing your insights. And
thank you, Florence.
Everything that you know in this specific area, and I know you know a lot more, so maybe we'll have some future discussions. And I want to thank you all for joining us. And we want to say goodbye for now, and we hope you enjoy the rest of the Converge to Accelerate event.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity, Florence. And great. I hope folks have a great time at this event. And if anyone is wanting to follow up, we have a couple of books out of MIT Press on this topic. One is called, you know, Data is Capital, which is an interesting title on its own. And then we have another book called Trusted Data. This is all the stuff that Florence is asking about, the provenance of data, data co-ops, and so on. But look it up at, you know, MIT Press.
Thank you. And I'll mention a couple of the books on tips. So there are a couple of Springer books that I've brought out with 17 women authors and each of them with me. One is Women Securing the Future with Tips for IoT. And one is Women Securing the Future with Tips for Connected Healthcare on the Trust, Identity, Privacy, Protection, Safety, and Security. You can find those through Springer or Amazon or your favorite, whatever, like you're talking about, Thomas. And so you can tell we're all very mission-based about this. How do we help? How do we help the citizens? How do we help the industry? And how do we help us move forward in this constantly connected and even more connected world? So thank you again, everybody, for joining us. Have a great event, and we hope to see you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.